Anyway, on to food on the home front. Away from the front line, the war resulted in food shortages, rationing and distribution problems. Food shops were also a target of public anger. For example, after the sinking of the Lusitania by a German U-boat in 1915, resulting in the deaths of 1,200 people, there were food riots up and down Britain. In his 1934 memoir, the autobiography of a Liverpool Irish slummy, Pat O'Mara recalls the escalation of tension in the aftermath of the disaster.
It took about 2 days for the names of the drowned among the crew to be published. They were appalling. We walked around Scotland Road listening to the cries of the women whose husbands and sons had gone down in the Lucy, and we heard the bitter threats made against Germany or anything with a German name. We walked down Boston Street, where practically every blind was drawn in token of death. All these little houses were occupied by Irish coal trimmers and firemen and sailormen on the Lusitania, and now these men, who barely 2 weeks ago had carried their bags jokingly down the street, were gone, never to return. Some of the women, drunk, were laughing as mad people laugh when the borderline had been passed. On the corner of Scotland Road, ominous gangs were gathering, men and women, very drunk and angry. Something was afoot. We could sense that, and like good slummy boys, we crowded around eager to help in any disturbance.
Right, a pork butcher's shop, Bryce, was the first casualty in the riots that followed. Why pork shop? Why pork butcher shops?
Well, they're very visible markers of an ethnic community, the German community. And, of course, Dublin was no exception. There's riots in Dublin, German pork shops at the outbreak of war. If you think about walking down the main thoroughfare in a big British city today, you'd see various markers of, say, the Asian population. At that time, if you read the Home Office files, 60 to 70% of pork shops in London, for instance, were German. So the Germans were quite visible. The problem is that a lot of these riots, as they are wont to do, take a bit of a wrong turn, because every shop with a funny-sounding name is then smashed in, including some Russian shops who, of course, are allies to the British at the time. So we look at the direction of the riot and the direction of the crowd. It's not all a sort of anti-German logic. But at the same time, it was perceived as a war crime. The Lusitania was a big outrage at the time. So there was a sort of moral dimension to it. And when you tie that in with the issue of food pricing and economics, you're starting to go towards not your classic moral economy food riot, but there's tinges of moral economy there. I mean, of course, the riots take a bit of another wrong turn when in Liverpool, and including the Irish slum community like Pat O'Mara, go and smash up the Chinese quarter as well. And China, of course, at that stage is neutral. So we can't say it's a clearly situated thing. Germany's the enemy. Pork and Germany are the same thing. Pricing issues.
You can eat pork. Mm-hmm. I mean, that has to be a factor as well. Are we not talking really here about glorified looting?
In some ways, and we're talking about hungry people, but in other ways, it's an issue of morality. It's an issue of pricing in wartime. And, you know, as John will tell you as well, in wartime, prices always go up. There's always rampant inflation. There's always enhanced morality around consumption. So German pork shops, okay, it's racist, it's moronic, but there's aspects, I think, there's tinges of perhaps an older moral economy there. Now, I don't want to romanticise things, but there's notions there that aren't purely just moronic and racist.
It's interesting because Pat O'Mara does mention in his in this autobiography, this memoir, that certain people were spared. In some cases, people who did actually have German connections, but they were still spared. Why?
Some considerations of the mob for people who gave more on the collection at mass. Say you had Irish women who were married to Germans and they were renowned as putting a few bob in the church collection every week. They were spared. But then he goes on to describe how certain other Liverpool people married to Germans were actually with big families to support weren't spared. So it's a very sort of spur of the moment stuff. But there is, again, a sort of moral logic perhaps to some of it. You know, if you're a good mass goer and all the rest and, I don't know, a daily communicant, you might be spared. So there's issues of morality tied in. It's not just sort of clear-cut idiocy.
There was an upside, though, for the people who were burnt out or whose shops were broken into, whose shops were looted, because they were compensated and sometimes they emerged stronger from the experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And you look at the role of the state. I mean, you know, after the Lusitania goes down, you've got a lot of British propaganda saying, men of Britain, will you stand for this? Avenge the Lusitania. So in some ways, the state's sort of culpable. If you think about, you know, morality again in wartime and the role of the wartime state in stoking up this sort of, you know, xenophobic resentment, But the state does compensate the Germans. It also interns a lot of them in internment camps for, I suppose, public safety, for their own safety in some regards. But it's an interesting issue of identity, the issue of aliens during the warfare. In terms of O'Mara, he says the most tragic consequence for him is a pernicious bellyache he gets from all the raw sausage he's been eating.
John, there were food shortages in this country in 1970. What was the cause of the food shortages? What was the nature of those shortages?
Well, you start seeing food supplies kind of in terms of, in terms of what's going on in Britain, you have to feed all these massive armies, these big citizen armies that have risen up. There's been a dislocation in terms of the economy, in terms of you're taking a lot of people out of the economy, putting them into uniform. Crops and farm production went down. And so a lot of the food is being diverted to the troops. So you also start seeing kind of an increase in inflation and food inflation. And in Ireland, you start seeing a lot of stuff disappearing. So, and it's real core stuff that's really important to normal working people. So butter becomes very hard to get. Potatoes become hard to get. Milk is becoming scarcer. It's becoming a lot more expensive. So that starts creating a lot of anxiety. And this really continues into 1918. And in the beginning of 1918, when food rationing is brought in to Britain, it's also, you know, becomes a big issue in Ireland. And probably the big thing driving it is you have unrestricted U-boat warfare in 1917. And so all of a sudden, the North American food supplies aren't getting to Britain. Also, Russia is out of the war. Russia's grains off is taken out as well. So there's kind of a confluence of events has created food shortages in Britain, and that's also kind of spreading over to Ireland, and that's creating a whole lot of public anxiety.
And the Great Famine was actually invoked in all of this. Is that realistic or was that just hyperbole?
Well, it seems very realistic in terms of that was a real fear that they actually thought there was another famine. They also kind of the people who are speaking out, not just the Republicans, also kind of moderate nationalists, they're also evoking kind of the traditional nationalist interpretation that Ireland starved because food was taken out of the country during a crisis. So that's when you start seeing these food preservation efforts. You also start seeing a kind of an outbreak of agrarianism, a lot of animosity towards people who are raising, who aren't tillage farming. So kind of the cow versus plow tension. You know, that just really kind of explodes in January, February 1918. And it's really tied into kind of these shortages that are coming in from this unrestricted submarine warfare. And in Ireland, they're very much aware of this because there's so many ships being sunk in Irish waters. So it's hard to hide from the Irish public how much this kind of the U-boat warfare is affecting food supplies.
Somebody asks a very good question. We're an agricultural country. How could there be food shortages? Was there a lot of food being exported? I mean, I note, for example, one of the tables you have there, that livestock exports from Cork up considerably between 1911 and 1917.
Absolutely. That's what's happening is Irish food is being raised and is being sold in British markets and is disappearing from Irish markets. And that's causing a great deal of unease. And then and on top of that, the inflationary pressures are becoming increasingly high. So for big farmers, this is great. They're making a lot of money. For people who are on fixed incomes, for people who are working in the cities and towns, for people who might not be getting war bonuses, all of a sudden a lot of food is becoming unaffordable. And in some cases, it's becoming unavailable. And what you see in Central Europe, and Bryce, you might want to come in here too, with countries that you have food shortages and there's a lot of discontent, a lot of time it's not real hunger, it's fear of hunger. And that's what you see in Ireland. And Ireland, when you talk about the Great Famine being a living memory, fear of hunger is a real thing to a lot of people.
I think you've got the role of the state as well. And in Ireland, the compulsory tillage measures are resented by people. It ties into that welter of nationalist agitation at the time, the overbearing state and all the rest. And again, in Europe, this is a big issue. And across Europe, of course, there's food riots. It doesn't just happen in Ireland and Britain. We know, you know, from the Russian example, the German, very good examples of food riots kicking off.
And then also the British government is also highlighting, emphasizing the fact that the Germans are suffering from food shortages. So that's very much part of British propaganda. So all of a sudden, Irish people are starting to see this, and it's kind of raising the worry and the concern among ordinary people to a significant extent.
Did Sinn Féin capitalize politically on fears of famine or the kind of food anxieties you're talking about?
I'd say they were using it. They were very much to the forefront of trying to whip up kind of action against food exports. But at the same time, they were also working hand in hand with labor. The Irish Labor Party and kind of trade councils were very much on board with this. So it was kind of a joint action. It seems that they legitimately thought that Ireland was going to starve. And that kind of, you know, face that kind of was part of their worldview of how Britain viewed the Irish and kind of their own view of Irish history. They seem to have been legitimately fearful about the case. But at the same time, also, the whole idea of Sinn Féin is ourselves alone, you know, moving forward, us taking care of things ourselves. So it really fit into their view of how the Sinn Féin should govern and how kind of the independence movement would come about. So it was a confluence of good kind of political work things, and it all kind of worked together for them. At the same time, it got a little bit out of hand pretty fast, and it put them off this kind of social agitation, especially later on in 1920 and 21.
Rationing is introduced, Bryce, in 1918. Was that an attempt to resolve the difficulties that had been posed by war profiteering and the perception, and perhaps the reality, that the war was making no impact, in food terms at least, and in other terms as well, on the ruling class? Was it an attempt to resolve those difficulties, or was it a desperation measure?
I think on the one hand, it's a desperation measure, as John's mentioned, the unrestricted submarine warfare of 1917, the German U-boat campaign, which is really damaging British supplies coming in, especially from North America. You know, it's something that's to be repeated in the Second World War, like a lot of these themes are. But it's also to do with that, you know, anti-black market, anti-hoarding message. You do get food queues developing in the major British cities. So it's a bit of both, really, I'd say.
And does, in Ireland, John, does the food crisis pass, or was it just superseded by the conscription crisis in the spring of 1918?
It passes, you know. So you have large scale land seizures and land agitation in January and February. You have a bunch of food preservation committees are set up kind of around the country, mainly by Sinn Féin. But basically, the convoy system has kind of solved a lot of the U-boat problem in terms of ships are now being escorted over, and the sinkage goes way down. So not that many ships are being sunk. And then also the kind of these the food efforts to kind of, you know, beer brewing is reduced to much extent. Bread is being made in a different way. So they're kind of saving a lot of grain. They're also kind of bringing in they'd been laissez-faire before, and the government is really starting to intervene and really control food consumption. And so all of a sudden the numbers start going down, and so demand starts decreasing, and it's all kind of comes together. So things get kind of better. They don't get that much better, but they don't get any worse, and that's what's really important. And then, as you said, conscription comes in about a month or 2 months later, and then that becomes the main focus. But things don't get much worse, and that's kind of critical, and that's because the British government successfully intervened to kind of sort the problem out.
And how close did Britain come to being essentially knocked out of the war in military terms and in terms of the home front after, say, the big German offensive in March of 1918?
Well, you read the stories, and according to some sources, it's sort of 6 weeks. You read different sources, 4 to 6 weeks, Britain comes from running out of food supplies. But I suppose that the British are quite successful in imposing rationing in a way that the German home front isn't successful. And there's that aspect, I think, of meat consumption, for one, is always higher in Britain, although it drops, than it is in Germany. And again, if you think of, you know, nutritional consequences as we know today, you know, it's not imperative that people are eating red meat. You know, vegetable diet's more important. But at the time, it's morale. And morale seems to hold in that year, in 1918. I think a big thing as well is warehousing and distribution. So confounding all those stereotypes of German efficiency, the Germans don't have as efficient a sort of distribution system. And the British really avail of a very efficient railway and warehousing system in terms of food supplies in the British mainland.
Couple of your texts before we finish. Margaret Shine says, at least two ships carrying horses to the war in Europe were disabled and put into Queenstown, which is, of course, Cove, County Cork, during the early years of World War One. These events are recorded in the Cork Harbour Pilots Logbook and in Cork Harbour Journals of the time. Both these original records will be on display in the Cove Museum from the 1st of April until October. And Mary McIntyre has a question. She's wondering if you know anything about young Irish men who were conscripted into the US Army in 1914 to 1918. Well, it would have been 1917 to 1918 in exchange for US citizenship. I think my granduncle was one of these. He left Donegal around this time and was killed in a US uniform near Verdun 2 weeks before the end of World War One. He's buried in the American cemetery there, surrounded by lots of Irish sounding names. If anybody's got any information that Mary would love to hear about it, I don't know if either of you have any information on this particular topic. No reason.
A lot of Irish served in the American forces. Pretty much one of the most famous American units in the First World War was the Fighting 69th, which was Irish American, kind of had an Irish American identity. Made very famous by a movie in the 30s by our very famous Irish American Jimmy Cagney, playing a cowardly soldier who becomes a hero.
And the Bill Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, to lead the forerunner of the CIA, the OSS.
Just quickly on the subject of horses, of course, a lot of the food going over is for the horses, and some horses actually end up on the plates as well. I did the children's show last week where I wasn't allowed to mention this because the popularity of War Horse and all the rest would have the children crying, but, you know, horses do end up in the diets, in the trenches as well.
Yeah, well, we'll absolutely avoid that one. I won't talk about that one. We leave it there. And War Horse, as you know well, is running currently in Dublin. Bryce Evans and John Borgonova, many thanks for joining me this evening. This coming Wednesday, the one-day symposium examining the moral, nutritional, social and economic role of food and drink in the First World War will be held at Liverpool Hope University. Full details of the food and the First World War symposium, they're on our website, as well as additional information about this item.